Abortion is a real tragedy here in the latter half of the 20th century, latter quarter of the 20th century, and in our country, the USA. The figures I've got here to illustrate the problem come from an annual statistical abstract of the United States, and I've got information from the 1990 abstract, the most recent one I was able to lay hands on in our area, and then the World Almanac. Figures for how many abortions have been performed take a while to collect. They're largely collected by the Alan Guttmacher Institute, which is the research arm of Planned Parenthood, so by a group that is favorable to abortions. What I've done here in this first chart is we've got the year down the left-hand side, 1973, 74, etc., and then the number of legal abortions in thousands. So the number of legal abortions for 1973 were 744,000. Okay, the next column is not thousands, okay, but is in 1973, the first year that abortion was legal on the basis of Roe versus Wade. It had been legal in some states before that time. There were, out of every 1,000 live births, there were 239 abortions. That's what that's doing. So that number is to be taken straight without sticking thousands or anything on it. But all the other columns are by thousands. There were 56,000 infant deaths in 73, 116 accidental deaths of people of all ages in 1973. There were 19,600 murders in 1973. There were 51,400 forcible rapes in 1973. And by some fluke, there were 1,973,000 deaths of all sort in 1973. So that's not another date column over on that other side. It just happens that that particular year, that's what was going on. If you look down the legal abortions column then, which is the next last left column, you'll see that the numbers have risen from about 750,000 up to about 1.5 million per year as of the last recorded figures back in 1985. And as of the time the 90 statistical abstract went to press, that was the last figures that were available. So for the past, since about 1979, you've been averaging more than 1.5 million abortions per year. The columns below that are comparing U.S. abortions with U.S. war deaths, and likewise, the numbers are in thousands. We have the name of the war down the left-hand side from the Revolution to Vietnam. The situation in Desert Storm involved so few casualties on the American side that you would probably get effectively zero and zero in thousands on the two there. The second column is those who actually died of wounds. That's basically what that means, either directly in the battle or battle-inflicted wounds. And then the various other complications that can arise are the non-battle deaths that we see down that column. And that amount has tended to go down as medicine has gotten better. And then the total on the right-hand side. I mentioned in our summary observations on page 2 that since 1976, when legal abortions climbed above 1,100,000 for the first time, that since then, every year that we have records on, and probably every year anyway, there's no reason to believe that between 85 and 90 the numbers have dropped substantially, that there have been more U.S. abortions each year than the total number of war deaths in U.S. history. So very, very substantial carnage involved in the death of all of these infants. In the back on page 1, just below the big chart and to the right of the smaller chart, we have abortions compared to major causes of adult deaths in 1985. Last year, I've got figures available. Total number of deaths in the U.S., born people, infant through elderly, is 2.086 million, okay, or 2,086 thousands. That is, notice, somewhat bigger than the total number of legal abortions at that time, but not a whole lot bigger. And in fact, if you go to the two major causes of death, cardiovascular, hardening the arteries and heart attacks and all of those sorts of things, that they account for just under 1 million deaths a year, and cancer, the second major cause of death, accounts for just under 500,000 a year. The two of them together, 1,440,000, and that is actually smaller than the number of abortions per year. So the major cause of death in the United States is abortion, outranking by by over 500,000, outranking by 500,000 the next major cause of death, which is heart disease of one sort or another. If we compare abortion to the Jewish Holocaust, the best figures that have been obtained are those reported in the Encyclopedia Judaica in the article on the Holocaust. And obviously it's tough to get exact figures because the problems of record keeping and that sort of thing. But their estimate from all the work they could do was a little under 6 million deaths of Jewish people in Eastern Europe by the Nazi authorities during the late 30s up through 1945 when that part of Europe was liberated, 5,821,000. Notice that legal abortions in the U.S. through 1978 already were topping that particular figure. So if you look at my observations, which are on page 2, which pull together some things out of this, these charts, more U.S. abortions each year than the total war deaths in U.S. history. that the Nazi Holocaust surpassed U.S. abortions by the middle of 1978, by the end of 1990, going at 1.5 million per year since 85. We estimate that the total U.S. abortions are almost 25 million, about four times the Nazi total. Several other items here I mentioned I want to take a look at with you. Look back on the first page at the forcible rape column next to the end on the right. There are doubtless more rapes than this that take place in the United States because not everybody reports them. I don't know what the underreporting is. That's also true of abortions, by the way. Not everybody reports them either. figure on forcible rapes has risen substantially since 73. I think it's risen substantially faster than the population, but I didn't think to pull a population figure into these records to see what the average chance would be of a forcible rape and such. But many as they are, 88,700 in 1985, that abortions outnumber that by about 20 to 1. So even if you assume that every forcible rape produced a pregnancy and every person for whom that happened felt that it was necessary for them to get an abortion because they couldn't possibly put up with this thing that had been forced upon them by someone else, that that would still account for no more than 5% of the whole total situation here. And therefore, whatever one might say about whether it be okay to have an abortion or something in that particular case, we're talking about a very small fraction of the actual abortions that have taken place. That is a side issue from the main issue of why are 1.5 million taking place per year, and what does this tell us about where our society is headed and that sort of thing. One other point under some observations, it's the next to the last one there under my some observations on page 2, we think about how quality of life is improving in this country, that the expectation of how long we can live is gradually rising, and it's gotten up into the 70s here in the last 20 years or so. And yet, if you factor into that the children that are aborted before they come to birth, you find that the actual life expectancy has dropped rather drastically, and the life expectancy, if you count them as well as the people who are born, is actually about 53 years and getting down very much into third world numbers as a result of what is going on there. But the way you work that out, obviously, is work out the number of births per year and multiply that by the average life expectancy that is published in typical tables, and then add to that the number of abortions per year and multiply that by zero and then divide the thing by the total number of born and unborn and such. And it gives you that kind of a figure. Scientific considerations regarding abortion. That's just a little attempt there of looking at the problem to try and suggest for you that we are not talking about something small. We are talking about something that is widely practiced, around which a very substantial industry has built up, which stands to make a great deal of money, does make a great deal of money, stands to lose a great deal of money if laws should be passed against this. You can see there are some very strong feelings and there are some very strong forces at play in this whole area. We want to look this morning at some scientific considerations regarding abortion, some ethical considerations, and then see what the Bible has to say about the particular thing. In looking at scientific considerations, one item that comes up rather frequently is safety to the mother. And obviously, if you have a child born by C-section or an abortion by C-section, those are procedures that are basically the same thing, and presumably the dangers as far as the actual surgical procedure and such are very much the same. If you bring a child to term to be brought to birth, there are some complications that can arise because the head of a child is often very nearly the same size as the head of the opening that a woman can make, cervix there, I guess, I'm a biologist. And basically, there are situations in which there are very, very difficult births and that sort of thing. So there can be some dangers in childbirth, whether it be natural childbirth or childbirth assisted in a hospital, that sort of thing. There is, however, some consideration, which I don't mention in the notes here, to psychological effects of birth versus abortion and that sort of thing. And there appears to be a growing amount of information of very serious psychological results to women who have had abortions and that sort of thing. I've seen some of the material. I've not written up any here because I'm not ready to make any discussions on that. I don't feel like I have background, but I just mentioned it here. However, when you talk about the safety, why should one restrict the consideration just to the safety of the mother? Obviously, if the child is human, then the safety of the child would make some difference as well. And one thing we can say about safety of the child is abortion is not safe for children. They don't hit 100%. They come awfully close. And that is a very, very serious matter. When we talk about women's rights, and certainly we should be concerned about women's rights, at least half of the people aborted are women. And what about their rights? What about their rights? But we're trying to stay on scientific considerations, not ethical considerations. And the real scientific consideration, I suppose, is the fetus human? Is this just some of the mother's flesh? And is no more serious a matter than having some unsightly fat removed, as people who are concerned about their appearance will occasionally do by surgical procedures. I know some friends who used to say, would you like to lose 15 pounds of ugly fat? Cut off your head, etc. Come back to the scientific subject. But I mentioned rather facetiously that the fetus is not an onion. It's not a bird. It's not a rabbit. Not a monkey. Not a fish. Despite the rather dated remarks about gill slits, etc., in the early development of the human child, etc. What scientific warrant do we have to claim that the answer is no, a fetus is not human? Well, one can make arbitrary definitions, if you like, of when a fetus becomes human. It's birth, and then presumably all Caesarean operations. The being is not human for a while until the time of natural birth would have been reached. What happens when you open the mother and take out the child before the child would otherwise have been born, as is sometimes done for the safety of the mother in various circumstances? What do you do that converts the child from a non-human to a human? So you do anything. Now, it's clear that as the fetus develops in the womb, the fetus becomes capable of more and more things that a grown human can do. No question about that. And I think a big influence in thinking about whether the fetus is human or not has been an acceptance of the theory of evolution and a belief that somehow evolution is rerun in the womb in some sense, so that when the child is just the fertilized egg, why, that's no more than an algae sort of thing, although it has rather little resemblance to an algae. And as you work your way up, well, then you're at the tadpole stage, and then you work your way up to the rabbit stage and that sort of thing. And that is just not a widely used argument for evolution anymore, because the path taken in development of the child from the one cell all the way up is a different pathway. The order in which the tongue and the teeth develop are different than is theorized in evolution and things of that sort. Basically, if you're going to start with one cell and work up to a human who has... used to tell me in school that the human has about 2 billion cells. Somewhere between there and now, they've gotten up to 20 trillion. And how it jumped by a factor of 10,000 in 50 years, 50 years since I was in school, 40 years, I don't know. But the process to get from there to there, from the single cell to the other, is something that is programmed by a set of information in the child with cooperation from the mother and such. And it is not clear that any line is crossed that the person is human after, but not human before. if one is going to draw any kind of a line, the neatest place to draw a line is between the unfertilized egg and the fertilized egg. the unfertilized egg will not develop into a human, does not have a full set of genetic information that is in the human. The fertilized egg does have the full set and will develop into a human if nothing goes wrong. Will develop into a full child if nothing goes wrong. And so I don't think there's any reason to argue that the child becomes a human at any point. The consequences of that ethically are rather serious, and we will make a look at a couple of those. A number of people want to talk in terms of viability, that when the baby becomes viable, that baby is then human in some sense. But viability is a matter of a very relative thing. A baby just born is not viable without very careful care from somebody or another, whether it be the natural mother or a nurse or something of that sort, because a baby cannot feed themselves and cannot get water and that sort of thing. A baby is very, very helpless. The baby's able to breathe. The baby, as those of you who have had children know, cry pretty easily and have ways of signaling and that sort of thing. But they're certainly not able to handle themselves. And in fact, the growth of a human into a full, functional, self-operating adult, etc., is a very long, long process. And there are people for whom various difficulties have occurred to them that never make it, although they in fact live to old age. They always need to be cared for by somebody. And one can argue whether their quality of life is such that you ought to put them out of their misery or something. It's not a scientific question, though. Certainly the scientific thing is that the transition, if anywhere, is going to be at the fertilization of the egg, not at some position along the line. One might argue, now, when the intelligence reaches a certain level, the person is human. That begins to lead us into some rather strange ethical directions, namely, what ought to be the cutoff for human, and what do we do with the people who are below the cutoff? And if we're worried about overpopulation on the planet, should we raise the cutoff? And all of those sorts of things. You can see some serious, rather complicated things arising. You're opening quite a bag of worms in that particular direction. Certainly, it is true, as I say, that a child just born cannot take care of themselves. It is true we have premature births of various sorts that even the mother is not capable of taking care of the child at that level the hospital needs to. But that's really just a different caretaker, and the better technology you got, the earlier and earlier you can do that. Though obviously there are limits unless somebody's able to build some kind of artificial womb that will do all the things that a mother does for the child. Whether that's anywhere close on the horizon or not, we will have to wait and see. Scientifically, I think we can say this, that it is not obvious that anywhere while a child is in the mother's womb that that child becomes a human and somehow its rights ought to be protected when it crosses the barrier, but ought not to before they cross the barrier. Since the Supreme Court decision in 1973 allowed, in certain cases, abortion even up to up to the last weeks or so before delivery, etc., it's certainly not all obvious that anything particular happens in that direction. I want to talk a little bit about ethical considerations. In an article that appeared in the Washington Post back in just a few weeks ago, rather surprised me when I saw it. I grew up in Washington, D.C. area, spent my summers there. And the Washington Post is not exactly a flaming conservative newspaper. And yet I thought this was a rather interesting editorial they had in there. It was a guest writer of some sort. Peter J. Reiga is an attorney in Houston and is given no more identification than that in this particular article. The article is entitled Civil Disobedience, the Last Resort. The difficulty of being a judge can at times be overwhelming. Not often, but sometimes. I think of enforcing the law when the judge knows that a crook will go free, or when an injustice will be perpetrated, or when the judge imposes a death sentence. He does it because it is the law, without which, even when it is unjust, there would be anarchy and chaos. That is the nature of a democratic society. The judge need not agree with the law, but because of this law, he is sworn by oath to enforce it. There have been two testing fields for that proposition, it seems to me, when this justification for the law has not worked. I have been unable, rationally, to come up with a satisfactory solution to these two extreme dilemmas in the law and morality. The two cases were slavery, 1776 to 1865, period of time of U.S. Declaration of Independence to the end of the Civil War, and abortion, 1973 to 1991. Both cases are intractable to all the normal explanations of law, morality, democracy, because they both involve a direct assault on innocent human life. The cases of slavery, Dred Scott decision, and abortion, Roe versus Wade decision, are remarkably alike in their conception and in their constitutional history. They are both unique in that they involve human life, but the dispute, then and now, is whether the subjects, slaves on the one case, the unborn on the other, are human beings. Both cases deeply divided the nation because there is no compromise when it comes to human life. It is protected or it is not. The best and easiest argument is that slaves and the unborn are not human in being. That was the exact argument of the slaveholders in Dred Scott and of the radical feminists in Roe versus Wade. The Taney Court, the court that decided on a Dred Scott decision, and the Berger Court, the court that decided on Roe versus Wade, held the very same view. Thus, both Dred Scott and Roe versus Wade argued that slaves, substitute the unborn, are not persons in the Constitution. Slaves, substitute the unborn, are property to be disposed of as the slave owners, substitute women, desired. Slaves, substitute the unborn, have no rights that anyone need respect. The response of abolitionists to Dred Scott was massive civil disobedience, freedom statutes in the northern states, Underground Railroad, that sort of thing, as it is now with groups such as Operation Rescue for the Unborn. Dred Scott was resolved in blood and steel through 4 years of civil war. Roe is currently being fought in this country nonviolently so far, but the outcome is as yet unclear and uncertain. For the members of Operation Rescue, as for the abolitionists of 1840 to 1861, the only recourse when a matter so grave affecting innocent human life is in jeopardy is civil disobedience. Is there any other alternative? Is it possible to compromise when people are killing innocent human beings? Whether or not we agree with Operation Rescue, we should appreciate the dilemma faced by these people. They are not criminals or common lawbreakers, as Judge Patrick Kelly of the District Court of Kansas seems to think, but people of moral conviction who cannot stand idly by while the innocent are led to the slaughter. It is the very same dilemma that faced the abolitionists almost 150 years ago. They, too, were called fanatic even by Lincoln. From our vantage point today, who is right, Lincoln or the abolitionists? Then as today, there was not on record a single federal judge who ever resigned or refused to enforce the law returning slaves to owners. Just as today, there has never been one federal judge who has refused to enforce, protect, or even promote Roe versus Wade. The argument of federal judges then as now was that Dred Scott, Roe versus Wade, was the law and that it had to be enforced under pain of anarchy and disorder. But for the abolitionists, for those of Operation Rescue, it is a disordered order that kills the innocent. It is better to have turmoil than the killing of innocent persons. We still blame the Germans, good Germans, who knew of the slaughter of the innocent in the camps and did nothing. The people of Operation Rescue are not being good Germans. There is something honorable about having deep moral convictions and acting on them nonviolently. It is admirable to witness a whole group of people suffer humiliation, jail, and deprivation of their own freedom rather than be silent before what they deeply believe to be the destruction of innocent human beings. Therefore, Judge Kelly must recognize that the nonviolent civil disobedience of Operation Rescue is the final response of desperate people who believe that the innocent are being butchered each day. Their nonviolent disobedience to its lawful order is in the finest tradition of American jurisprudence in the time of great stress and turmoil. Unless Judge Kelly wants bloodshed in the streets as during the Civil War, he must respect the breakers of his order even as he must arrest them. This civil disobedience is the only moral way left open for these people to express their complete opposition to the slaughter of innocent children, no matter how well-intentioned those who do such things really are. Nonviolent civil disobedience is the last barrier to violence and bloodshed. For more than 60 years, the abolitionists tried nonviolent civil disobedience to slavery laws. It didn't work. Is there a compromise possible on Roe versus Wade? Only time will tell. But it does little good for people like Judge Kelly to accuse these people of being lawbreakers, criminals, and disobedient to lawful authority, because there is the rub. Is there an authority to kill? That picture, I think, that article, I think, sets out for us the ethical thing that is involved in this particular question, and that is a desire on the part of those who are performing abortions, who are receiving abortions, etc., to somehow say that it's all right for me to do this to these others because they really aren't people, they don't count as much as I do, and that sort of thing. The question I suppose you have to ask is, what standard for behavior is being used in these particular cases? Is it the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you? Would you, if you were developing the womb, want to be killed? Very clever little cartoon book I have seen that visualizes this particular problem from that perspective. One of the I've been doing some reading on the Civil War just in the last year as a spin-off of the public TV series on the Civil War, and read some biography of Lincoln, and read the big Civil War book that came with that, which was bought for Christmas for me, and two or three other works. And one of the works about Lincoln very much struck me because he laid his hand on a principle that I do not see how the slaveholders could have gotten around, and I think it's one of the things that led to a whole series of irrational actions that led into the Civil War, and that was this. You say slavery is okay, but you're not willing to be a slave. You're not willing to take the golden rule and turn it around, that somehow it's all right for other people to enslave you. But if you're not, then can you really justify that action? Many other religions, other than Christianity, have something like the golden rule, which is sometimes called the silver rule because it's constructed in negative terms. It's not a positive statement that you ought to be out there doing good things to other people, but it is at least a negative statement that you ought not to be out there doing bad things to other people. And it's typically structured, don't do to others things that you wouldn't want done to you. But by the application of that principle, which is virtually universal among all moral systems that have been proposed in human history, would you want to have your life terminated before you ever had a chance to try it out? And even in cases where there's arguments about quality of life and such, we can find many, many people who are physically impaired, mentally impaired in various ways, that still seem to get some real enjoyment out of life. And although we, I think, rightly ought to pity them and help them in many, many different ways, it is easy to see that it is hard to set a general rule that everybody who is in those circumstances would have wanted to have been aborted if they had had a say in the matter and that sort of thing. It's true that there are people who have various types of handicaps who have not made good adjustments to it and would argue that they would like to get out of this life, just as there are many people who are in excellent physical shape who have opted to commit suicide and that sort of thing. But the question of what they might want to do is not something that ought to be solved for them by somebody else without checking their own desires in the matter, independent of the question of the morality of suicide. Immanuel Kant is a rather famous philosopher from around 1800 who I'm afraid has done some rather substantial damage in dismantling the idea that one can really know anything about God and such, and by turning away from very important biblical evidences. And yet he felt it was quite important to have a basis of morality, and he was not able to get it from revelation because he had rejected the evidence for biblical revelation. But he basically constructed this one, which I think is a helpful moral rule that can be used, and that is, you should not do any action that you could not make into a universal principle that people, everybody ought to be allowed to do that sort of thing. And that, I think, again, would be another sort of principle that you see right here that really undercuts the argument that it's okay to do abortion. Is it all right for everybody to do abortions on everybody else, etc.? And it is very difficult to see how to make a statement in that particular direction. Personal right really brought up in the whole abortion question. And the idea is, doesn't a woman have a right over her own body and that sort of thing? And obviously a question that arises any time one talks about personal rights is, where do my rights end and your rights begin. And again, coming back to the fact that we have no scientific warrant for arguing that a baby in the womb is not a human, how is it that the mother has the right to cut that all off, etc.? And I compare the problem here with slavery. Is it all right for one person to enslave another, to get work out of them, and that sort of thing? And the kind of answer we would give for why that is not okay is very difficult to see how that will not also function against slavery as well. What about non-voluntary euthanasia? Euthanasia is ending the life of an elderly person, perhaps when they are no longer as functional as they once were. We may not be all that far away, who knows, in our society from the idea that if a person has stayed in the hospital too long and the funds have run out, well, just kind of pull the plugs or something like that. So I can see that going on already. There's already been a case or two in that direction. And that may sound not so bad to you if you are the an executive of the insurance company and you're paying the expenses for this sort of thing. But if you're the person that's lying in that bed, and although you can't do as much as you used to be able to, you would very much like to keep living for a while longer. You can see how pulling that plug is not going to be something that you really look forward to. I think you can see the same kind of problems out. And the Holocaust itself would be another example where the question of personal rights of the political leaders of the country to deal with a divisive social problem, they felt this was the solution to the Jewish question. And yet surely there are very, very serious problems there. When we read about the Roman Empire early in its history after around the time of Christ, we again and again hear about people who had a child that was unwanted, and they would just sit them out in the garbage pile or something of that sort. And some of those children would die, but probably the majority of them would be taken by somebody and raised to be sold as slaves or prostitutes or something of that sort up the line. And the question again is, was it really the right of that father or that mother to abandon the child in that particular way? Or does this whole matter of sexual relationships and the growth of the baby in the womb not impose an obligation upon the people involved, the father as well as the mother, that they have by undertaking this activity? It is not just a recreational activity. It is an activity that puts into them some consequences that they have to deal with in an ethical way. And I think what we see there is something rather important in ethics, and that is the idea that somehow your actions don't have consequences, and if they do, anything you can do to get out of those consequences is okay. We may find again and again that our actions have big consequences beyond them, and that may therefore be a reason for why we should be very careful of getting into that. Much of the abortion dilemma, the abortion tragedy, is the offshoot of all of the idea in the 60s. If it feels good, do it. Don't let anybody tell you what you have to do. And now we're seeing that that, in fact, produces a society which is a far nastier society than the original proponents thought it would be. And we can, I think, see that the abortion dilemma is part of that problem. The drug situation is a part of that problem, which has continued to come on strong. The AIDS epidemic is a part of that problem, which is beginning to have effects. And all of these things have effects beyond the people who do them. They have effects on other people as well. So, huge ethical situation here that it seems to me that the arguments are really very much on the one side, but there are many people on the other side who don't want to go that way. And they will resist that in emotional ways, in political ways, in financial ways, etc., to keep the thing going. That's exactly like slavery. Exactly like slavery. We got to the place where people were justifying slavery out of the Bible, which was widely accepted in both the North and South at the early in the last century, middle of the last century. Although it's quite obvious that although slavery was allowed in the Bible, it was not considered a good thing. That one of the curses that would come upon the Israelites for disobeying the covenant was that they'd be enslaved. There was something very much to get out of. It was a disaster that was characteristic of human nature, but it was nothing to encourage. And that was basically part of the argument of those, certainly the argument of those abolitionists who accepted the Bible. We move on to biblical considerations. And I structure them, first of all, by coming in from the most broad pictures of our responsibility to God that Scripture gives us. And that would be what is often called God's first great commandment. It's not actually the first commandment of the ten in the Ten Commandments, but it's a commandment given in Deuteronomy 6:5 and then repeated in Matthew chapter 23:37 in the parallel passages where Jesus is talking to a legal expert in Judaism. And in one of some of the reports, we have the lawyer giving this, and some of the reports, Jesus giving this, and he may be looking at a situation where the one said, that's right, and the other actually said it. Compression of the account, you know that. But the commandment says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and all your soul, and all your might. And the picture here then is, if you really want to have a life that is worth living, and that counts for anything, you need to know God, and you need to love Him, and you need to want His will to be done in your life. One of the characteristics of abortion is a desire to turn aside a providential event that has happened in the life of that couple, and that is that the sexual relationship has produced a pregnancy. Whether that's within marriage, as some of these abortions are, or outside marriage, as many of the abortions are, that is still something that has happened as a result of their actions. The biblical picture is God brings to pass everything that actually occurs, and our responsibility is to react properly to those things. Some of them are very good things, and reacting properly is thanking God for it and seeking to use those good opportunities in a way that would please Him. And some of those things are tough things. And there's no question that there are people who are poor who are looking like they're going to have some more children, and it's really very expensive for them, and it's tough to see how they're going to manage well with that. And yet a person who is willing to love God with their heart and mind and fully trust God in that circumstance and try and see what they could do to deal with that in a fair way. So the first commandment, that we love God with all that we have, means we are willing to take the circumstances He sends us and work within them, trusting Him to help us out. And God will often bail us out of difficulty we saw no way out of. The second commandment comes from Leviticus 19:18 and is discussed by Jesus and this lawyer in the same context in Matthew 23:39. And it appears from the lawyer's answer, etc., that already the legal experts of Judaism at New Testament times had seen that if you pull these two verses together, you kind of get a compendium that is a summary of our responsibility that kind of pulls the Ten Commandments together and condenses them in these two statements. And Jesus backs them up on that. They made a right conclusion on that matter. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And what that basically means is that the people you come in contact with, you should be willing to trust God enough to show them the same kind of consideration as you would show yourself, to show them the same kind of consideration as you would want shown to you. And that basically then is how that goes. The lawyer himself raised what he probably thought was a good legal question, and which others perhaps might have thought was a quibble of some sort. Who's my neighbor? Is this a restrictive principle that I should love my neighbor as myself, but somebody doesn't qualify for neighbor? This doesn't apply. I don't need to do that with them. And basically what Jesus does in his story of the Good Samaritan, which follows right after that, is to show that even a person who is your enemy, in this case an ethnic national enemy instead of a personal enemy, you should treat with such consideration. The Good Samaritan, Samaritans have very bad relations with the Jews, rather like the Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland are, or the blacks and the whites in South Africa or something of that sort, yet endangered himself to help this guy lying half dead by the roadside who had been hit by marauders. The guy who helped him certainly didn't know that the robbers might not be hiding somewhere behind the boulder or something, or just over the hill, and yet he stopped and helped the guy and took him to an inn and cared for him that night as he stayed at the inn and gave some money to the innkeeper to try and pay for his lodging, whatever he would need to get back on his feet in a few days and such. And no one, we see the guy went out of his way to help this other person. Now, if we guide our lives by those actions which immediately are of aid to us at that point, and we've got to look out for number one because nobody else will, etc., we are not going to follow that kind of a principle. But if we really believe there's a God in heaven who controls the events, who's a good God, who wants us to be agents with Him in making this earth a better place to live, then we can trust Him with our safety, with our money, with our time, and really reach out to help people that are in need around us as we have contact with them. How does that apply to the abortion controversy? That child in the womb is the neighbor of the mother and father. That mother and father are the neighbor of people around them. We as Christians ought to reach out to help such couples to work through and avoid abortion and try and go on ahead and really turn their lives around and help this thing. Maybe they need to get married. Maybe they need to commit themselves to raising the child and loving the child and that sort of thing. And just to try and help them, if they will, to turn from their lives of going their own way, sex as recreation, etc., to trying to figure out what, after all, sex is really designed for, and trying to fit in with God's intention for the marriage relationship. The Bible speaks in several passages of the sanctity of human life. The Bible certainly indicates that animal life is important, that plant life is important. We are not to be messing up our environment. We are not to be wantonly killing animals and such. And yet the Bible also indicates that it is possible to be one who loves God with all your heart and mind and still eat meat. That it is not a wicked thing to kill certain animals for food and that sort of thing. And yet it makes a rather drastic distinction between mankind and animal life. The account is found in Genesis chapter 9, verses 3 through 6. Let me read that passage to you here. Two numbers turned around in my head while I was looking through here. Here we are. The circumstance is right after the flood. Noah's come off the ark. Every moving thing, says God to Noah, that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. You're to bleed the animal, and we're not told all the ins and outs of this, but basically you're not to eat it with its life, that is its blood. You're to pour out its life in some sense before you eat the animal. I think there's some symbolic significance there as well. And then he turns to human life, and surely I will require your lifeblood from every animal, I will require it, and from every man. From every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Man is not a proper part of the diet. And frequently we see cannibalism practices, not an everyday practice. It's some kind of a sacramental practice in that society. And very frequently you find when people are actually talked to that they have great horror of it. Somehow they think they're getting some great benefit from this. We do that sort of thing. Some rather nice discussions of that in I've got these things in my notes, but some work by a recent missionary who has studied the ethnic behavior of cannibal tribes. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. Man shares great similarities with the animals in a number of things. Our biochemistry is very similar, the kind of things we eat, very similar, all of those sorts of things, but there's a great difference between man and the animals, and that is we share something of God's image they do not. And we aren't told all the ins and outs of that, but it has something to do with personality, has something to do with our being guided by moral standards instead of by what we might call standards that sort of operate automatically, instinctual standards, that sort of thing. And the result of that is that a killing of a human in some way is diminishing God's image in some way. It's an attack on God's image in some way. And so that is the distinction made there. Exodus 20:13 then does bring us into the Ten Commandments, those ten statements that summarize the obligation of mankind to God. And they summarize it on a slightly broader, more detailed more developed way than the two commandments, love God with all your heart and mind, and so love your neighbor as yourself. We now begin to get some specifics of how that works out, and then other parts of the scripture develop more and more specifics, particularly of the Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And so here we have verse 13, translated in the King James, thou shalt not kill, but more accurately translated from the Hebrew, you shall not commit murder. It's not about killing animals, though there are certainly ways in which a person can sin by wantonly killing animals or being cruel to animals or things of that sort. It's about humans, and it's not about the question of whether the state has the right to bring the death penalty on on evildoers for particular actions that they may have carried out, but it's a statement about the activity of private citizens of killing innocent people, and obviously it has generalized applications to the responsibility of a state not to be putting people to death who are not guilty of the specific crimes for which the Bible specifies a death penalty. So we have God's great commandments, loving God with everything. We have the command of loving neighbors as self. We have the sanctity of human life, seen in distinction from the animals in Genesis 9. In Exodus 20, the 6 of the 10 commandments, you shall not commit murder. Just one chapter over, in Exodus chapter 21, there's an example of an abortion among the case laws of the New Old Testament. Much of the Old Testament is made up of case law, specific examples, giving you illustrations of how your major principles are to be carried out in practice. Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 through 25, gives a specific example. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he, the one who is responsible, shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. Those who feel that abortion is okay, but who also feel that you need to justify that opinion from the Bible, basically argue here that what happens is you have a spontaneous abortion taking place, well, not spontaneous, a accidental abortion taking place here when this person is hit, a miscarriage, and the child comes out dead. And they say, see, here is an abortion, and yet it's not punished with a death penalty or anything of that sort, that there's no indication. It's only punished if the mother has further injury to herself besides the miscarriage, then there will be a penalty for that particular thing. Well, let's suppose for a moment that that's the right interpretation of the passage. I think it's not. I'll come back and say a word about that in a moment. But supposing that's the right interpretation of the passage, what we find out here is, in fact, there's a strong penalty for accidental death of the child and such. And this is just accidental. This is not premeditated. The Scripture doesn't have a penalty for accidentally killing an adult. Only premeditated killing an adult. But here's a penalty for accidentally killing a child. And I think what you see is that it's not a strict accident. We're involved with negligence. The two guys are brawling. They ought not to be doing that. And they run into a passerby, this woman who is pregnant and such. Actually, when you look at the Hebrew, however, it does not say she has a miscarriage. In English, that would mean the child is born dead, typically. It says the child comes forth. The person has a premature birth. And then the question is the child dead or alive? Does it say at this point? It says if there's no further injury, or actually the Hebrew, if there's no injury, he, the guy who did this, shall be fined as a woman's husband may demand of him. He shall pay as the judges decide. There's a penalty for endangerment of some sort, rather like a civil suit might be. And then if there is injury, and if you read this as the child comes forth, then that injury may perfectly well include the child as well as injury to the mother. And then you get these penalties of eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, essentially, which is saying that the penalty is apportioned to the amount of damage done. And that's an accidental case, not in the case of an intentional abortion. That is the one specific passage on abortion we have. But given that there's no scientific evidence that the child in the womb is not human, then God's great commandments, his statements about the sanctity of human life, come into play as well. In our last couple minutes here, I want to read these four passages for you, which speak of something very important about what the Bible tells us, what kind of people we ought to be and how we ought to conduct ourselves, and those involve care for the helpless. Because if there's anyone who is helpless in society, it's the child in the womb. Exodus chapter 22, verses 22 through 24. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, says God, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. God says, if you begin to mistreat the helpless, I am going to cause circumstances to come about that you are going to be mistreated, and the picture here would be an invasion of some sort. A breakdown of law and order might be another example of that. If God brought upon us a civil war or something of that sort as a result of this, we'd have to say he's very justified. If we won't care for the helpless, he won't care for us. Deuteronomy 10:18 explains why God says something strong like that. It shows us God's attitude towards the helpless and how we ought to be caring for them. Deuteronomy 10:18. For the Lord your God is a God of gods and Lord of lords, the great and mighty and the awesome God who does not show partiality nor take a bribe. He's not like human judges. The best human judges begin to give you a little glimmer of him. He does not show partiality or take a bribe. I lost my place here. 10:18. He executes justice for the orphan and the widow and shows his love for the alien by giving him food and clothing. God is concerned that those people who are helpless in a society be helped, and he will intervene to do that. James 1, verse 27, James is kind of pulling together, how do you tell real religion from hypocritical, legalistic, fake religion, etc.? You see it in care for the helpless. Pure religion, the undefiled, is care for the widow and the orphan, and that sort of thing. I close with a very familiar passage to many people. It's a judgment passage in Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, in which God, at the second coming of Christ, the nations of the world are brought together, and they stand before the Lord to be judged. And it says he separates the people one from another like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he says to the one on the one side, he says, come, you blessed of my Father, enter the kingdom that was prepared for you from the beginning of the world. Why? Verse 35, I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. Naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And they say, when did we do all that? And Jesus says, as much as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. And then he turns to those on his left and he says, depart from me, you cursed ones, into, get the wording here right, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels because you didn't do all these things. And he goes and lists the same sorts of things. Now, look at this for a second in contrast to what abortion is. In abortion, the person who commits the abortion, a mother who arranges to have it done, the abortionist who actually carries it, they put out of the womb a child who can only eat by remaining in the womb. They cut off the satisfaction of the hunger. They take this person away, the person is not able to drink. So to the thirsty, they turn them away. To the food, the hungry, they turn them away. To the stranger, and even in the rape, I might say it's a stranger, it's half a stranger or something of that sort, throw them out, etc. Naked, well, they're sort of clothed with the fluid in the womb. I don't want to push this too far. But they're put out of that womb where they're warm and protected and out into the cold world and to die. What we see there, I think, very clearly is it's not hard to see how God will view those who participate in, encourage, and such, these kind of actions. The Lord offers forgiveness to those who will turn from their wicked way and turn back to God. He has provided deliverance. He's provided forgiveness and such. But he warns us not to continue in that way. And we as Christians need to do what we can to not only be confrontational in this matter, but also to try and help people who have been duped by the new morality into doing things that are making a mess of their lives. And yes, that the Lord would help us to be a person to bring blessing and encouragement to those people, that they might be able to overcome this. We look back now and say, although we don't agree with some of the things those abolitionists stood for in other areas, they did a good work back in the middle of the last century in trying to stop this thing, and they're the heroes now at this distance. Do we want to be 100 years from now the heroes, or do we want to be the good Germans who stood by and did nothing while things were being done this way? I ask that the Lord might help us to do the right thing for his glory and because it's right. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, thank you for your word. Help us, Lord, to be the kind of people you want us to be,
that we might one day hear from you, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord. We pray in Jesus' name.